So tonight, I've pulled some of the selections out of the collection called Kruba Ajahn, put together by Ajahn Chandiko. And these specifically come from Tanajan Biek. And they're specifically interviews Ajahn Biek had with Western monks at Wat Nanachat and at various monasteries. So there's a fair amount here. I'm not sure I'll get through it. And I thought to start with some of the lighter material where he's at Wat Nanachat, just speaking casually with the monks, and then maybe time permitting, getting into some of the more concrete practice oriented material. So again, this begins with question and answer at Wat Nanachat. This question: how does one tell the difference between sloth and torpor, which is one of the five nivarana, or hindrances, and real tiredness of the body? And Tanajan Biek responds: if you sit in meditation after a full sleep and your body is still nodding, then this is a nivarana. But otherwise, this is a very subtle issue. You already need to have a certain amount of samadhi to know. Normally, you can't tell what is nivarana and what is tiredness of the body. Question: so how should one practice then? And the response: just keep doing the practice. Whatever state the body may be in, inside you can still experience feelings of coolness, peace, rapture, and joy. If we can't control our body, but still control our minds, that's good enough. Question: what does controlling the body mean? And the answer: it means to sit with a straight back, as they say, jagariyanu yogo, wakeful. However, if we can't control the body, it must be very tired. Then, leave the body, just take the mind. Make the mind peaceful, that's better. When the mind has fully entered samadhi, then there is no sense of the physical body at all. And the question: it is often said that before one begins to contemplate the body, one needs a foundation in samadhi and peace. I find the peace and samadhi that I experience in Anapanasati is reasonably okay. When I try to contemplate the body, the samadhi seems to completely fall apart. It seems no matter how deep I go with samadhi, still, when it comes time to contemplate the body, that samadhi doesn't help me. And Ajahn Biek: the strength of your samadhi is not enough to contemplate the whole body. You need to contemplate it in parts. If you think you've reached a good level of samadhi, but you can't contemplate afterwards, you need to take out just one part of the body, as your strength isn't enough for the whole. If you believe you have enough samadhi, but you can't use it, then it actually wasn't enough. So take out one part as a meditation object. For example, see hair as hair, nails as nails, teeth as teeth, or whatever you like. Afterwards, when your strength has gradually increased, you can integrate the parts, bit by bit. Question: so the purpose of contemplating the body is to see that it is non-self, and yet I can say to myself when contemplating the body that I understand it's not self. I feel I see that. Then, while continuing the contemplation, it feels like I'm going through the motions, because I think I already understand the body is non-self. In effect, I sense that the investigation is not working. And Ajahn Biek: this is because your understanding only goes as far as the things you can recall from memory. Your heart really doesn't know not-self yet. It's just anatta-sanya, the perception of anatta, not real knowledge. We can practice this way for some time, but it doesn't always work, so we will soon come to doubts again. This is because one has not yet experienced real knowing. We know because of our memory, but this can fail too. Since we don't know for certain, the knowing may fade away. Real knowledge doesn't fade away. But even though one has only perceptual knowledge, it can develop into true knowledge in accordance with reality. This is the actual training. But for now, we begin with the perceptions and memories we have, although right now we can still not discern between sanya and panya. Question: so when the thought arises, I understand this already, I shouldn't believe it? Answer: not believe it in what sense? Question: if I have the thought, I understand anatta already, when contemplating, do I believe that? Ajahn Biek: No, believe these thoughts to start with until they are firmly established in the mind. Finally, they enter our heart, and we really know that there is non-self. But first, let's start with believing. Start with believing through sanya, and later it will develop into panya. Do you understand? And this is Ajahn Kevali's question. Yes, in order to see anatta, we have to rely on building up sanya first. Still, I'm not sure whether seeing anatta takes place in a single span of consciousness or whether it gradually increases and we gradually see more. If it takes a lot of time, how can we practice in order not to give up on the way? Ajahn Bhik, when we use sanya in trying to see anatta, we will start to see more and more, and this seeing more and more will be the cause for letting go. If that's the case, we won't get discouraged. But if we don't really see, or only see based on sanya, we can become discouraged. Having authentic insight won't cause us to be discouraged because it gives access to growth. When we truly see, there will be aspects of panya coming up. It's not just seeing one particular point. Tankevali. So the insight builds up? Ajahn Bhik. Yes, and when it builds up, we will be more intelligent and clever in dealing with it. That means our sila improves, our samadhi, and our punya increases. Question. If one needs a good foundation in samadhi before one's investigation produces deep insights, then what is the advantage to practice investigation before one's samadhi is strong? Ajahn Bhik. It depends on your capabilities. When you do anapanasati, does your mind get peaceful? If it does not get peaceful, you can use investigation in order to make it peaceful. Investigation in this sense means to do samatha practice. It has not yet reached the vipassana level. You can use investigation in both ways, as samatha or vipassana. The way vipassana is often used actually is not vipassana, but rather refers to a way of making the mind peaceful. How people use the term vipassana is really confusing. Vipassana actually means the attainment of one of the four stages of enlightenment after already completing the practice of investigation. So in the way we use vipassana these days, we have changed the meaning. It's actually not real vipassana yet. This question. Some say that the human realm is the best place for the practice of Dhamma. Others contend that in different realms there are better possibilities and that it is easier to practice there. What is your opinion on this matter? Where is the best place to be born in order to practice the Dhamma? Ajahn Bhik. It depends on the preferences of each individual. In the human realm, the lifespan is very short. Therefore, looking at the shortness of life and work to be done, if it is possible to finish one's work and to end this whole mass of suffering, even in one life, then that's better. In the case of devatas and Brahma gods, their lives are very long. So in a long life like that, to finish one's work or, for example, to attain sotapanna, it will take very long, though it's comfortable in some ways. Generally, devas don't have to suffer as much. They already live happily. They like their lives, which means they are still attached to happiness. He goes on with a simile. The deva life could be compared to living in a 5-star hotel. This is a simile I once heard Ajahn Jayasaro use in a talk. For those who live in a small grass-thatched hut, the 5-star hotel may seem better. But living in a hut, people still have the possibility to do good and put forth effort. If they do this until the very end, they don't have to live in their hut anymore. They are finished. Whereas if somebody living in the 5-star hotel who is putting forth effort in practice but doesn't succeed, they may think, well, at least I'm better off than in the little hut. Question. A friend of mine has the opinion that an arhat has the power to come back to be reborn again. He also believes that bodhisattvas, as understood in the Mahayana tradition, can reach full enlightenment with no more kilesa, but still can come back to another life. Is that possible? Ajahn Bhik. You can believe this, but if someone really completes the full enlightenment of arhantship, he doesn't come back. He enters final nibbana. Question. This may seem to be a strange question, but I'd like to ask, is it wholesome to desire psychic powers, or is it kilesa? Ajahn Bhik. It's kilesa. Question. They say the greatest miracle or power of the Buddha was actually his ability to teach others. How can this be deliberately cultivated? Is this a psychic power that one should strive to develop? What if I desire to be able to perform the miracle of teaching others? Ajahn Bhik, you can cultivate it, but it takes time. But if we can't do it yet, we try to obtain the same power of inspiration that the bodhisattvas have, who keep going on further and further. We might think we can practice the same, but do we have the power to say to ourselves, keep fully on this track? We can develop a practice to go and teach other people, but is the power of our inspiration really enough? How far does it take us? It may sometimes be just another ordinary idea, and not a wish that's strong enough to carry on for many more lifetimes. This is the case if our strength right now is still little. Our spiritual perfections are weak. And this is a question from Ajahn Jayasaro. I'd like to ask another strange question. Do bodhisattvas, as depicted in the Mahayana Sutras, really exist? Take Kuan Yin, for example. Ajahn Bhik. My feeling about whether they really exist or not is not sure. But concerning bodhisattvas and the way we talk about them in the Theravada tradition, they can really exist. Just assume that we continue to do the practices we have already done in this lifetime, on and on and on, in future births, until our parami, our perfections, are full. Then we arrive at Buddhahood. As I have heard, those who really have the parami, they have the capability to know that they are on that path. The bodhisattvas know what to do in each particular life. For example, which parami to build up in this lifetime and which in the next. This means that through their aditanas, their determinations, they can become Buddhas in the future. According to what I've heard from Kuba Ajans, who have direct experience in this area, they say that if they have the necessary and sufficient parami in this lifetime, they could attain arhantship straight away, but they don't want to. Their wish is to be bodhisattvas, and in the future, this can lead to success. However, this is different than if someone just now says he'd like to become a future Buddha. This only has effect in this life, and how much it carries on in future lives is not for sure. Question. Many Kruba Ajans in their previous lives had made aditanas to be bodhisattvas or pacheka Buddhas, and this later proved to be an obstacle. How would any of us know if we had previously made such an aditana? How could it manifest as an obstacle, and how could we resolve it? Ajahn Bhik. I would say our parami is probably less. These kind of obstacles shouldn't appear. If we had the necessary parami, we would be able to know for ourselves, since certain things would come up and make us understand. Most of the people that aim at Buddhahood would find the practice of analyzing the body not suitable. They would take another path, mostly that of the abhinyas or psychic powers. But concerning you, your parami is only a little. It might be that you've taken the vows like that before, but suppose you had really taken them, you wouldn't forget. And this goes on. This is a part of a conversation between Ajahn Chandako and Ajahn Bhik. And this is, it comes in part way, Ajahn Bhik. It's good that you contemplate side by side with developing samadhi. When moods and emotions based on kilesas or arom arise in the mind, the panya vimutti practitioners, or wisdom practitioners, those who rely initially on contemplation to make their minds peaceful, will only fall back a short way, if any. For those only practicing samadhi first, before taking up investigation, cetta vimutti, when an arum arises and the samadhi isn't there, it's as if they haven't practiced at all, up to heaven and down to hell. However, if the samadhi is stable and unwavering, it can effectively keep all arums at bay and protect the citta from becoming defiled. Before the citta has sufficient strength of samadhi, it is good to rely on secluded and peaceful surroundings with minimal sense impingement, a non-stimulating environment. In busy situations, however, one must also contemplate so that if the samadhi isn't strong enough, there is some wisdom to back it up. Be aware, though, that wisdom at this level is mostly thinking and remembering, not true wisdom. Developing wisdom and samadhi side by side is more tiring for the mind than developing only samadhi. You've got to keep at it, even when you are exhausted. The important thing is to mentally separate the body into its parts until it is seen as empty. Question. What do you mean here by empty? Answer. Anatta, devoid of self, with nothing left. Using mental images or nimittas, dissect and dismantle your body until there is only your skeleton remaining. Then turn the bones into dust and have it disappear, returning to the earth element. Even when visualizing oneself as a skeleton or a corpse, there can be attachment remaining. Question. If one is regularly contemplating the body using such nimittas, what level of samadhi is necessary to realize Dhamma? And Ajahn Bhik. It's not necessary to think in such terms. As soon as the mind comes out of being unified, then investigate. When the Eightfold Path comes together as one, you'll know Dhamma. At this stage, you should focus on keeping the mind free of the five hindrances at all times by really pushing yourself in your efforts. Eat little, sleep little. Take food that's not your favorite, or if you take food you like, only take a little. Don't allow any indulgence in eating or drinking. That is, if you see the mind getting satisfaction through eating, then cut it off with samadhi or contemplation. Try to get by with 3 or 4 hours sleep. When sleepiness arises, find ways to counter that nivarana. When Longpo Cha was tired, he could enter samadhi for 10 minutes and come out bright-eyed, free of nivarana. Most of us, however, have to develop other means. When you wake in the morning, mindfulness must immediately be at that place that awareness was focused before falling asleep, whether it be the breath, the hand, or whatever. This way of training is difficult. You have to be willing to give up all the little pleasures and comforts if you wish to make progress in meditation. Question. Who was it that taught you to contemplate the body? Answer. Longpo Cha. He taught us how to investigate to see it as impermanent, not self. Generally, though, he spoke about mind contemplation. As with many of the Krupa Ajahns, people often hear the teachings and mistake the beginning for the end and the end for the beginning. In question, could you please elaborate on that? Ajahn Bhik. Usually, Longpo Cha's Dhamma teachings were concerned with examining the mind, mental states, citta. That's what he's known for. But Longpo's citta already had a sound and solid foundation. His samadhi was brimful, so he was able to look at the citta. Those of us who are just beginning, however, need to study, train, and practice Dhamma until it is well established. We have to try to cultivate samadhi. Once samadhi is adequately developed, and we then investigate, the foundation grows increasingly sound and well established. Longpo didn't explain in detail about this phase. We've all heard his Dhamma talks. He didn't say much about the beginning, the phase concerning samadhi. Mostly, we've only heard, go straight to the citta. Your average person, however, without strong samadhi, isn't able to investigate the citta because the mind doesn't have the ability to remain still. But somebody with good samadhi, with a solid foundation, is able to care for their citta and have it rest motionless, not too high, not too low. We have to rely on both phases, but Longpo usually only taught the latter, that of investigating the citta. Anyone who's practiced will know for themselves that if there's no peace of mind, we can't examine the citta. We can examine it, but it's not the same as the way the Buddha examined it, not the same as the Krupa Ajahns or Longpo Cha. It's just continuous thinking. Question. From the beginning, should one focus on all four satipatthana? Answer. No, just the body at this point. This is the easiest. The others require more strength of mind. And if the samadhi is not strong enough, investigation of the citta merely becomes thinking. If one has very strong and stable samadhi, then when mental phenomena arise, sati is there instantly, and the thought or mind state vanishes in a flash. When I say focus exclusively on the body, I mean as your stable base. If your awareness is with your body, you will automatically be aware of what arises in the heart. However, at this point, if you try to go straight to the citta, you won't necessarily be aware of the body. Go on to one final talk, and again, it's a Q&A between Ajahn Chandako and Ajahn Bhik. And it says, upon being asked about another monk's explanation of Nibbana, Ajahn Bhik, the Krupa Ajahns rarely say anything directly about Nibbana, because it is beyond the realm of possible experience of a normal person. Even if the people listening believe the explanation, it still doesn't actually help them much. And if they don't believe it, they make a lot of bad karma for themselves. So the Krupa Ajahns usually refer to it using metaphors, or refuse to speak of it at all, only teaching the path to get there. The important thing is to keep going straight without stopping. For example, say you want to go to Fakram village over there. If you follow the path and keep walking, you'll get there in a short time. If you stop to take a look at something and then chat with people, then go off with them to go see something else, it will take a long time before you reach Fakram village, if ever. But the reality is that almost everybody gets sidetracked, or at least stuck in samadhi, thinking they've arrived already. Even Longpo Cha was stuck for a while, Tanajan Mahabua for 6 years, Longpo Tape for more than 10 years, Ajahn Sot for 20 years. Ajahn Chandiko's question, is that because to all intents and purposes it appears to be full enlightenment? Ajahn Bik, yes, there seem to be no kalesas whatsoever. Everything is clear. Many people don't make it past this stage. Other people practice 5 vasas, 10 vasas, and still feel they haven't made much progress and get discouraged. We want us to keep in mind that it is always only a very few people who have the parami to reach the goal. Compare it with the U.S. president or the Thai king. Out of an entire nation of millions, only one person at a time has the parami to be in the top position. You have to think in terms of what you're going to do to create the causes and conditions for future liberation. Effort is what makes the difference. There are thousands of monks in Thailand who ordained with the sincere intention to realize Nibbana. What sets people apart, why some succeed and why others don't, is mainly due to their level of effort, as well as the effort they've put forth in the past. People have to train themselves to the point where it becomes an ingrained character trait to be continuously putting forth effort, whether they're around other people or alone. Some people are very diligent as long as there's a teacher or other monks watching, but as soon as they're alone, their effort slackens. When I was a young monk and my body was strong, I'd stay up later than everyone else, walking Jhongrom and see the candle lights at other huts go out one by one. Then I'd get up before the others and watch the candle lights gradually being lit. It wasn't like I had it easy. The kleshas in my heart were always trying to convince me to take a rest, saying, "You're tired, you need a rest, you're too sleepy to meditate." But wisdom fights back. What are you going to do to overcome sleepiness? Keep going. Sometimes the kleshas would win, but then I'd start again, and eventually they weakened. Question. It's often when samadhi or vipassana has been going well that kleshas seem to arise the most. At such times it seems like I've got more kleshas than ever. Is this normal? Answer. It's very normal. The average person has a huge amount of kalesa. Just to recognize that one has a lot of kalesas is already a big step. Even the sotapanna has many kalesas to get free from, much work to be done. Even at that stage, it's not as if everything is comfortable and easy. It's as if there is a vast reservoir of kalesa which gradually comes to the surface, and it's not easy to know how much is remaining. Just when you think you've fully gone beyond a particular kalesa, it will arise again. This happens over and over. The only thing to do is keep using panya to keep pace with it, meet and let go of the kalesas as they arise in the present. And a question. Have you ever heard or met anyone who attained enlightenment by only contemplating and not practicing samadhi? Answer. No, if you want a straight answer. Samadhi is essential for the mind to have enough power to cut through kalesa. However, if one is practicing vipassana with the understanding and intention that it will lead to the development of samadhi at a later stage, this is a valid way to go about it. Almost all meditation monks, Thais as well as those born in Western countries, have a character such that they need to use a lot of panya right from the very beginning in order to gradually make their minds peaceful enough that they can develop samadhi. Only a very small percentage of people are the type to fully develop samadhi before beginning vipassana. Question. Can it be said how deep and strong samadhi must be in order to attain magga and pala, or path and fruit? Answer. It must be strong enough to be still and unified as one, without any thinking whatsoever. There will still be awareness, knowing what one is experiencing. Question. Depending on whether one is in a remote location or in a busy monastery, should one's Dhamma practice change or remain the same? Longpo Bik. Dhamma practice takes on a different character if you are in a city or busy with duties in a monastery. In the forest, there are few external distractions, and it is easier to make the mind peaceful. However, if there is a lot of sense contact and dealing with other people, it is essential to figure out how to not pick up other people's defiled emotions. Otherwise, what happens is that the people around us feel lighter and we feel heavier and heavier. It's necessary to be able to completely drop the mental engagement as soon as the interactions with other people are finished. Otherwise, when one goes to sit meditation, one has all the conversations and emotions of the day floating around in the citta. It's easy to say, just be mindful and don't pick up other people's emotions, but it is very difficult to do. Lungpur Cha could take on the problems and sufferings of others without picking up any of it himself, because his citta was very strong. The people around him didn't know what was happening. They just knew that they felt cool and happy around Lungpur. But this is not a practice for beginners. Most people just get burned out. Practicing in the forest is easier, and I recommend that you should, as much as possible, try not to get involved with too many responsibilities, especially being an abbot. If someone tries to tell you that you are selfish and should be helping others, reflect that this is due in large part to the conditioning from modern society. If the Buddha had thought that way, we never would have had a Buddha. In order to put your mind at rest, reflect on the goodness you've done and rejoice in the bharami that you're creating. Those who try to help others too much before they've helped themselves will never be able to reach or help beyond the superficial. If their teachings mislead others due to their own ignorance, they can make a lot of negative karma. Many of the Wapapong monks try to emulate Lungpur in his later years when he would talk with people all day, rather than his early years of difficult practice. But it was precisely those years in the forest that made Lungpur into the great teacher that he was. And question. Have you ever heard of anyone attaining enlightenment by any means other than analyzing the body into its component parts and elements? Answer. No. At the very least, when the citta is seen clearly, the knowing mind will return to thoroughly understand the body as anatta. And question. In one of Lungpur Cha's Dhamma talks, he says that even for arhants, there is still kalesa, but it is like a bead of water rolling off a lotus petal. Nothing sticks. How do you understand this? Ajahn Bhik. Lungpur used to use language in unconventional ways in order to get people's attention and make them think. What he was referring to was the body, the result of previous karma, but the citta was completely devoid of kalesa. Normally, people use other terms to refer to the body and the physical dukkha of an arahant, but Lungpur was quite creative in his use of the convention of language. Maybe leave it there.
Well, is that fairly common, I guess the idea of samadhi being, sort of being a master of samadhi and then having that then go back to insight? He said that was a rare kind of person who could do that, who would be able to master samadhi to the degree, take it to such a degree that then they would go to insight rather than he was emphasizing insight and saying that, you know, panya and that was the important thing. Is that fairly just normal, common?
That's pretty normal. I mean, what you're saying, that it's rare that somebody is so adept at samadhi that that's all they do, like focusing just on samadhi and then coming back, because that you have to, in reality, and what he was saying or how I understood it, that even your cultivation of samadhi relies on the application of wisdom, so it's a mutually supportive process.
Or would you be willing to talk about the difference between mindfulness and bare knowing, just the one who knows knowing?
Oh, well, I mean, one those are all mindfulness is fairly straightforward. Bare knowing is kind of a concocted idiom that was used for a while that I don't think is all that applicable. one who knows is kind of open to interpretation in many ways. Different people, different teachers use it in different ways. But certainly, when one who knows is the the quality, your direct translation of Buddha, so that you're talking about an elevated knowing, an elevated understanding. Mindfulness is a say like a tool or a quality of mind that we cultivate and develop and apply in order to establish a more consistent clarity and understanding. And certainly the Buddha didn't use mindfulness on its own all that much. Mindfulness was almost always coupled with clear comprehension, so that sati and sampajanya were fairly used as supporting each other in order for that mindfulness to be fully useful. In the Thai idioms that are used in speaking Dhamma, mindfulness is used a lot with banya, so that awareness and discernment. so that you have to pay attention to how different teachers are encouraging or using the terms, there's a constant, even the Buddha, when he talks of the foundations of mindfulness, that Satipatthana Sutta, when the Buddha defines mindfulness, then it has four particular qualities: the application of effort, the establishing of mindfulness in the sense of having that kind of awareness that is grounded, sampajanya, which is clear comprehension, and then having the vinaya lokeya pichatam, so that the function of mindfulness is also to pull out or relinquish the tendencies to liking and disliking. So it's a function of mindfulness. So that it's there's a constellation of applications of mind that even the Buddha, right in the foundation of mindfulness. It's not just mindfulness sort of somehow standing on its own, or which is sort of like the how the bare knowing as an idiom that was I don't know where it came from, 60s I think. So there isn't really some kind of pure knowing, that there's only this narrow spectrum of knowing. It's a dynamic of the mind that allows clarity.
clarity and discernment and a an ability to that quality. The one who knows is also somebody who doesn't suffer. In that sense, of the function of that mindfulness application of awareness is that one is it's for releasing the heart from suffering.
That first question about discerning between sloth and torpor versus tiredness of the body.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you might be able to say anything about this technique of Mupurkian, of like read about it described constant movement.
Yeah.
And just wondering if you could say anything about that, and like if you've known people who it's effective for it, or if yourself or other practitioners have known it.
I never really developed it. I kind of played with it for a bit, but it was, you know, I never heard about it until probably or something. So, I know different people who've used it and found it quite useful. And I think it is an effective way of grounding oneself in awareness, so that there's that. Physical movement because one of the things that of course is a contributing factor to sloth and torpor is the mind sinking in dhammas, so that physical movement. I mean the movement that it's how do you say it's circumscribed. It's just sort of you do a series of movements. Oh, can't remember what it is.
It's 14.
Like that. Yeah.
Cross open.
15 steps.
15 steps. Yeah.
Yeah. First. Well.
No. Yeah. Yeah. So when you're doing that, it's hard to fall asleep. You know, which is really good. So that there gets to be a momentum of awareness, because there's some, you know, just sitting, eyes closed, you know, you've got reasonably comfortable in your sitting posture, and you disappear into dominance. I mean, it's a very effective way of getting that momentum. So that the emphasis is on mindfulness, and I did something very similar my first year as a monk. Different teacher, different way of doing it. He focused on sensation and feeling and using vedana, vipassana, but it was similar, using a hand movement, and so that I got very, very strong concentration from that, because you start developing a particular sensation and then drawing that sensation into the heart and then cultivating that sensation in the heart. It was very subtle. But because you start close, then you're able to catch that particular sensation and then work with that. So I was able to get very, very concentrated.
That's great.
Yeah.
I didn't need a long time.
Yeah.
He was doing that for, I don't know if he's still doing it, he was doing it for quite a while.
He was doing quite a while. I mean, he got good results from it.
Yeah. He came to Kapananchat and was doing it, and Ajahn Yadgangwa didn't like people doing it in public. He wanted to kind of ban it, but a lot of us were starting to practice with it, and remember Rajanita Dhamma's didn't like it, and then he gave a dumb talk about it, and he claims that Lupatian used that to keep himself from going into like jhana.
Uh-huh.
He was supposed to be designed method just the opposite, but it obviously has good results anyway to get you there.
Yeah, well, if you're not going to, Ajahn Yan wasn't trying to extol its virtues.
Exactly.
Any method is, has its drawbacks and its benefits, and you have to learn how to. It isn't the method that's going to work, it's how you apply it and use it and become skilled with it. it isn't just because you sit and pump your breath in and out that you're going to get dazzling samadhi and brilliant insight. You have to learn how to bring the hindrances into abeyance, bring the mind to a place of stability and stillness, and then be able to reflect and investigate so that one is starting to understand the nature of the attachments and desire.
Is that just for torpor? Could that also be used for restlessness? Is that a...
There's no reason why it can't work. Just don't do it in the hall. It's sort of hand-waving meditations. There's lots of different methods. Ajahn Chah was never fixed on it. Never do this. There's no such thing as the Ajahn Chah method of meditation. What he wants to know is it working? Are hindrances decreasing and wholesome qualities increasing? Is the mind becoming more peaceful? Is it becoming more cloudy? Understand the nature of attachment and views.
Two questions.
Yeah.
First one is the question about the notion of dharma. Vivek is talking about it a lot. He may have a dharma, maybe you actually want. Did Ajahn Chah speak in those sorts of terms, or is that sort of some people get into that and some people don't?
He didn't talk about it too much, but it's a fairly standard concept in Thai, Theravada Buddhist culture. It's a pretty basic kind of concept.
I already forgot my second question.
Maybe quickly, about the Lupatian method.
Yes.
A lot of us actually were using it at Wapanacha, and he was thinking, I really enjoyed it when I was doing it, but I forget what it was now, because I was banned doing it in the hall, like he just suggested not to, but I was doing something with my fingers.
Yeah.
Very simple, but no one could see or something like that. I forget what it was, but it couldn't do 14. But
yeah, Ajahn Chah also used to do that as well. Just some kind of movement. So you're connecting the developing of a continuity of awareness with a physical sensation, physical movement. It doesn't have to be all that overt or strong. It's just enough to get the attention of the mind and which is sort of what the breath is supposed to do. But sometimes that's a bit too soothing, you know, or a bit too subtle.
I believe Lumbar Pasadam used to use a method of holding a needle between the thumbs.
That's correct.
I also tried that and it worked well.
That works really well.
You fall asleep.
You stab yourself. You have to have a very even awareness to be able to do, just take your sewing needle and holding it. I found it worked.
What if you have the opposite problem, where you're not tending towards soft and torpor, but you're more sort of jacked up, as it were?
Right. I don't have much experience with that. Now, a lot of it is finding ways to soothe. So that, like the breath, so that it's you're trying to make it, paying attention to rather than paying attention to the whole breathing, which is a bit energizing, then tuning into more subtle, because there's a lot of mind energy already, so then trying to tune into what's a bit more subtle. Like you're giving your mind a bit more work to do, because it's already energized, so then it needs to have a bit more subtle and paying attention to things that help to relax. Because especially if there is energy, but then you try too hard, then it creates tension as well. So there needs to be a balance where you're trying to refine and make that more subtle, but it's also relaxing. That's important.
I remember my second.
You got it now?
You gave the notion that Lumbar would sort of support any method that was producing the results that we're seeking. And so the question is what's a reasonable amount of time to give a method like balancing the needle to give a method a try? It reminds me of the joke, an overweight person complaining about trying to lose weight, and they say, don't tell me to try diet and exercise, because I tried that yesterday and it didn't work.
It's
a time scale of things.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you have any advice about if you're trying out a new method, how much time to put into it.
No, it's usually dependent on temperament. In the sense that some people he would be just be patient, keep doing it. And then some people, it was like, okay, that doesn't, that doesn't work, we'll try this. And so a lot of it depends on temperament and how willing one is to stick with something. Because once it starts to become frustrating, in the sense that one's getting frustrated and losing heart, then you want to be changing.
So in the first 5 minutes.
Then one has to be really innovative and have lots of options.
People needs to know the bar and the patience.
Yes. Okay.